down across from him in the dimness of the boat's interior, with a scarred plank table and a tallow candle between them. They were ice blue, pale, cold. The dwarf misliked pale eyes. Lord Tywin's eyes had been pale green and flecked with gold. He watched a sellsword read. That he could read said something all by itself. How many sellswords could boast of that? He hardly moves his lips at all, Tyrion reflected. Finally Griff looked up from the parchment, and those pale eyes narrowed. Tywin Lannister dead? At your hand? At my finger. This one. Tyrion held it up for Griff to admire. Lord Tywin was sitting on a privy, so I put a crossbow bolt through his bowels to see if he really did shit gold. He didn't. A pity. I could have used some gold. I also slew my mother somewhat earlier. Oh, and my nephew Joffrey. I poisoned him at his wedding feast and watched him choke to death. Did the cheesemonger leave that part out? I mean to add my brother and sister to the list before I'm done, if it please your queen. Please her? Has Illyrio taken leave of his senses? Why does he imagine that her grace would welcome the service of a self-confessed kingslayer and betrayer? A fair question, thought Tyrion, but what he said was, the king I slew was sitting on her throne, and all those I betrayed were lions, so it seems to me that I have already done the queen good service. He scratched the stump of his nose. Have no fear, I won't kill you. You are no kin of mine. Might I see what the cheesemonger wrote? I do love to read about myself. Griff ignored the request. Instead, he touched the letter to the candle flame and watched the parchment blacken, curl, and flare up. There is blood between Targaryen and Lannister. Why will you support the cause of Queen Daenerys? For gold and glory, the dwarf said cheerfully. Oh, and hate. If you'd ever met my sister, you would understand. I understand hate well enough. From the way Griff said the word, Tyrion knew that much was true. He has supped on hate himself, this one. It has warmed him in the night for years. Then we have that in common, sir. I am no knight. Not only a liar, but a bad one. That was clumsy and stupid, my lord. And yet Sir Duck says you knighted him. Duck talks too much. Some might wonder that a duck can talk at all. No matter, Griff, you are no knight, and I am Hugo Hill, a little monster. Your little monster, if you like. You have my word. All that I desire is to be leal servant of your dragon queen. And how do you propose to serve her? With my tongue. He licked his fingers one by one. I can tell her grace how my sweet sister thinks, if you call it thinking. I can tell her captains the best way to defeat my brother Jamie in battle. I know which lords are brave and which are craven, which are loyal and which are venal. I can deliver allies to her, and I know much and more of dragons, as your half-maester will tell you. I'm amusing, too, and I don't eat much. Consider me your own true imp. Griff weighed that for a moment. Understand this, dwarf. You are the last and least of our company. Hold your tongue and do as you're told, or you will soon wish you had. Yes, father, Tyrion almost said. As you say, my lord. I am no lord, liar. It was a courtesy, my friend. I am not your friend either. No knight, no lord, no friend. Ah, a pity. Spare me your irony. I will take you as far as Valentis. If you show yourself to be obedient and useful, you may remain with us, to serve the queen as best you can. Prove yourself more trouble than you're worth, and you can go your own way. I, and my way, will take me to the bottom of the Rhoyne, with fish nibbling at what's left of my nose. Vala Daenerys. You may sleep on the deck or in the hold, as you prefer. Ysilla will find bedding for you. How kind of her. Tyrion made a waddling bow, but at the cabin door he turned back. What if we should find the Queen and discover that this talk of dragons was just some sailor's drunken fancy? This wide world is full of such mad tales. Grumpkins and snarks, ghosts and ghouls, mermaids, rock goblins, winged horses, winged pigs, winged lions. Griff stared at him, frowning. I've given you fair warning, Lannister. Guard your tongue or lose it. Kingdoms are at hazard here. Our lives, our names, our honour. This is no game we're playing for your amusement. Oh, of course it is, thought Tyrion, the Game of Thrones. As you say, Captain, he murmured, bowing once again.
Davos. Lightning split the northern sky, etching the black tar of the night lamp against the blue-white sky. Six heartbeats later came the thunder, like a distant drum. The guards marched Davos Seaworth across a bridge of black basalt and under an iron portcullis showing signs of rust. Beyond lay a deep salt moat and a drawbridge supported by a pair of massive chains. Green water surged below, sending up plumes of spray to smash against the foundations of the castle. Then came a second gatehouse, larger than the first, its stones bearded with green algae. Davos stumbled across a muddy yard with his hands bound at the wrists. A cold rain stung his eyes. The guards prodded him up the steps into Breakwater's cavernous stone keep. Once inside, the captain removed his cloak and hung it from a peg so as not to leave puddles on the threadbare mirrorish carpet. Davos did the same, fumbling at the clasp with his bound hands. He had not forgotten the courtesies he had learned on Dragonstone during his years of service. They found the lord alone in the gloom of his hall, making a supper of beer and bread and sister's stew. 20 iron sconces were mounted along the thick stone walls, but only 4 held torches, and none of them were lit. 2 fat tallow candles gave a meagre, flickering light. Davos could hear the rain lashing at the walls, and a steady dripping where the roof had sprung a leak. "My lord," said the captain, "we found this man in the belly of the whale, trying to buy his way off island. He had 12 dragons on him, and this thing, too." The captain put it on the table by the lord, a wide ribbon of black velvet trimmed with cloth of gold and bearing 3 seals, a crown stag stamped in golden beeswax, a flaming heart in red, a hand in white. Davos waited, wet and dripping, his wrists chafing where the wet rope dug into his skin. One word from this lord and he would soon be hanging from the gallows gate of Sisterton. But at least he was out of the rain, with solid stone beneath his feet in place of a heaving deck. He was soaked and sore and haggard, worn thin by grief and betrayal, and sick to death of storms. The lord wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and picked up the ribbon for a closer squint. Lightning flashed outside, making the arrow loops blaze blue and white for half a heartbeat. 1, 2, 3, 4, Davos counted before the thunder came. When it quieted, he listened to the dripping and the duller roar beneath his feet, where the waves were smashing against Breakwater's huge stone arches and swirling through its dungeons. He might well end up down there, fettered to a wet stone floor and left to drown when the tide came rushing in. No, he tried to tell himself, a smuggler might die that way, but not a king's hand. I'm worth more if he sells me to his queen. The lord fingered the ribbon, frowning at the seals. He was an ugly man, big and fleshy, with an oarsman's thick shoulders and no neck. Coarse grey stubble, going white in patches, covered his cheeks and chin. Above a massive shelf of brow, he was bald. His nose was lumpy and red with broken veins, his lips thick, and he had a sort of webbing between the 3 middle fingers of his right hand. Davos had heard that some of the lords of the 3 sisters had webbed hands and feet, but he'd always put that down as just another sailor's story. The Lord leaned back. "Cut him free," he said, "and peel those gloves off him. I want to see his hands." The captain did as he was told. As he jerked up his captive's maimed left hand, the lightning flashed again, throwing the shadow of Davis Seaworth's shortened fingers across the blunt and brutal face of Godric Borrell, Lord of Sweet Sister.
"Any man can steal a ribbon," the Lord said, "but those fingers do not lie. You are the Onion Knight."
"I have been called that, my lord."
Davis was a lord himself, and had been a knight for long years now, but deep down he was still what he'd always been, a smuggler of common birth, who had bought his knighthood with a hold of onions and salt fish.
"Oh, I've been called worse things, too. I, traitor, rebel, turncloak."
He bristled at the last.
"I have never turned my cloak, my lord. I am a king's man. Only if Stannis is a king."
The lord weighed him with hard black eyes.
"Most knights who land upon my shore seek me in my hall, not in the belly of the whale, a vile smuggler's den, that place. Are you returning to your old trade, Onion Knight?"
"No, my lord, I was looking for passage to White Arbor. The king sent me with a message for its lord."
"Then you're in the wrong place, with the wrong lord."
Lord Godric seemed amused.
"This is Sisterton on Sweet Sister."
"I know it is."
There was nothing sweet about Sisterton, though. It was a vile town, a sty, small and mean, and rank with the odors of pig shit and rotting fish. Davis remembered it well from his smuggling days. The Three Sisters had been a favorite haunt of smugglers for hundreds of years, and a pirate's nest before that. Sisterton's streets were mud and planks, its houses daub and wattle hovels, roofed with straw. And by the gallows gate there always hanged men with their entrails dangling out.
"You have friends here, I do not doubt," said the lord. "Every smuggler has friends on the Sisters. Some of them are my friends as well. The ones who aren't, them I hang. I let them strangle slowly, with their guts slapping up against their knees."
The hall grew bright again as lightning lit the windows. Two heartbeats later came the thunder.
"If it is White Arbor that you want, why are you in Sisterton? What brought you here?"
"A king's command and a friend's betrayal," Davis might have said. Instead he answered, "Storms." 29 ships had set sail from the wall. If half of them were still afloat, Davis would be shocked. Black skies, bitter winds, and lashing rains had hounded them all the way down the coast. The galleys Alido and Old Mother's Son had been driven onto the rocks at Skagos. The Isle of Unicorns and Cannibals, where even the Blind Bastard had feared to land. The Grey Cug, Sarthasan, had foundered off the grey cliffs.
"Stannis will be paying for them,"
Salador San had fumed.
"He will be paying for them with good gold, every one."
It was as if some angry god was exacting payment for their easy voyage north, when they had ridden a steady southerly from Dragonstone to the wall. Another gale had ripped away the rigging of the bountiful harvest, forcing Sala to have her taken under tow. 10 leagues north of Widow's Watch, the seas rose again, slamming the harvest into one of the galleys towing her, and sinking both. The rest of the Lycene fleet had been scattered across the narrow sea. Some would straggle into one port or another, others would never be seen again.
"Salador the beggar, that's what your king has made me,"
Salador San complained to Davis as the remnants of his fleet limped across the bight.
"Salador the smashed. Where are my ships and my gold? Where is all the gold that I was promised?"
When Davis had tried to assure him that he would have his payment, Sala had erupted.
"When? When? On the morrow? On the new moon? When the red comet comes again? He's promising me gold and gems, always promising. But this gold I've not seen. I have his word, he is saying. Oh, yes, his royal word. He writes it down.
Can Salador San eat the king's word? Can he quench his thirst with parchments and waxy seals? Can he tumble promises into a feather bed and fuck them till they squeal?
Davos had tried to persuade him to stay true. If Salah abandoned Stannis in his cause, he pointed out, he abandoned all hope of collecting the gold that was due him. A victorious King Tommen was not like to pay his defeated uncle's debts after all. Salah's only hope was to remain loyal to Stannis Baratheon until he won the Iron Throne. Elsewise, he would never see a groat of his money. He had to be patient. Perhaps some lord with honey on his tongue might have swayed the Lycian pirate prince, but Davos was an onion knight, and his words had only provoked Salah to fresh outrage.
"On Dragonstone I was patient," he said, "when the Red Woman burned wooden gods and screaming men. All the long way to the Wall I was patient. At Eastwatch I was patient, and cold, so very cold. Bah! I say bah to your patience, and bah to your king. My men are hungry. They are wishing to fuck their wives again, to count their sons, to see the stepstones and the pleasure gardens of lice. Ice and storms and empty promises, these they are not wanting. This north is much too cold, and getting colder."
"I knew the day would come," Davos told himself. "I was fond of the old rogue, but never so great a fool as to trust him."
"Storms." Lord Godric said the word as fondly as another man might say his lover's name. "Storms were sacred on the Sisters before the Andals came. Our gods of old were the Lady of the Waves and the Lord of the Skies. They made storms every time they mated." He leaned forward. "These kings never bother with the Sisters. Why should they? We are small and poor, and yet you're here, delivered to me by the storms."
"Delivered to you by a friend," Davos thought.
Lord Godric turned to his captain.
"Leave this man with me. He was never here."
"No, my lord, never."
The captain took his leave, his wet boots leaving damp footprints across the carpet. Beneath the floor the sea was rumbling and restless, pounding at the castle's feet. The outer door closed with a sound like distant thunder, and again the lightning came, as if in answer.
"My lord," said Davos, "if you would send me unto White Harbour, his grace would count it as an act of friendship."
"I could send you to White Harbour," Lord allowed, "or I could send you to some cold, wet hell."
"Sisterton is hell enough."
Davos feared the worst. The three sisters were fickle bitches, loyal only to themselves. Supposedly they were sworn to the Aerons of the Vale, but the Eyrie's grasp upon the islands was tenuous at best.
"Sunderland would require me to hand you over, if he knew of you."
Burrell did fealty for Sweet Sister, as Longthorpe did for Long Sister, and Torrent for Little Sister. All were sworn to Tristan Sunderland, the lord of the three sisters.
"He'd sell you to the Queen for a pot of that Lannister gold. Ha! Poor man needs every dragon, with seven sons all determined to be knights."
The lord picked up a wooden spoon and attacked his stew again.
"I used to curse the guards who only gave me daughters, until I heard Tristan bemoaning the cost of destriers. You'd be surprised to know how many fish it takes to buy a decent suit of plate and mail."
"I had seven sons as well, but four are burned and dead."
"Lord Sunderland is sworn to the Eyrie," Davos said. "By rights he should deliver me to Lady Arryn."
He would stand a better chance with her than with the Lannisters, he judged. Though she had taken no part in the War of the Five Kings, Lysa Arryn was a daughter of Riveron, an aunt to the young wolf.
"Lysa Aaron's dead," Lord Godric said, "murdered by some singer. Lord Littlefinger rules the Vale now. When are the pirates?"
When Davos did not answer, he rapped his spoon against the table.
"The Lyseni,
Torrent spied their sails from Little Sister, and before him the flints from Widow's Watch, orange sails, and green and pink. Salador-san, where is he?
At sea.
Salo would be sailing around the fingers and down the narrow sea. He was returning to the Stepstones with what few ships remained him. Perhaps he would acquire a few more along the way, if he came upon some likely merchantman.
A little piracy to help the leagues go by.
His Grace had sent him south to trouble the Lannisters and their friends.
The lie was one he had rehearsed as he rode towards Sisterton through the rain. Soon or late the world would learn that Salador-san had abandoned Stannis Baratheon, leaving him without a fleet, but they would not hear it from the lips of Davos Seaworth. Lord Godric stirred his stew.
Did that old pirate, son, make you swim to shore?
I came ashore in an open boat, my lord.
Sella had waited until the beacon of the night lamp shone off the Valerian's port bow before he put him off. Their friendship had been worth that much, at least. The Lysene would gladly have taken him south with him, he avowed, but Davos had refused. Stannis needed Wyman Manderly, and had trusted Davos to win him. He would not betray that trust, he told Sala.
Bah! The pirate prince replied. He will kill you with these honors, old friend. He will kill you.
I've never had a king's hand beneath my roof before, Lord Godric said. Would Stannis ransom you, I wonder?
Would he?
Stannis had given Davos lands and titles and offices, but would he pay a good gold to buy back his life?
He has no gold, else he'd still have Sala. You will find his grace at Castle Black, if my lord would like to ask that of him.
Burrell grunted. Is the imp at Castle Black as well?
The imp?
Davos did not understand the question.
He is at King's Landing, condemned to die for the murder of his nephew.
The wall is the last to learn, my father used to say. The dwarfs escaped. He twisted through the bars of his cell and tore his own father apart with his bare hands. A guardsman saw him flee, red from head to heel, as if he'd bathed in blood. The queen will make a lord of any man who kills him. Davos struggled to believe what he was hearing.
You're telling me that Tywin Lannister is dead?
At his son's hand, aye. The lord took a drink of beer.
When there were kings on the Sisters, we did not suffer dwarfs to live. We cast them all into the sea as an offering to the gods. The Septons made us stop that.
A pack of pious fools, why would the gods give a man such a shape but to mark him as a monster?
Lord Tywin dead? This changes all. My lord, will you grant me leave to send a raven to the wall? His grace will want to know of Lord Tywin's death.
He'll know, but not for me, nor you, so long as you're here beneath my leaky roof. I'll not have it said that I gave Stannis aid and counsel. The Sunderlands dragged the Sisters into two of the Blackfyre rebellions, and we all suffered grievously for that. Lord Godric waved his spoon towards a chair. Sit, before you fall, sir. My hall is cold and damp and dark, but not without some courtesy. We'll find dry clothes for you, but first you'll eat. He shouted, and a woman entered the hall. We have a guest to feed. Bring beer and bread and sister's stew. The beer was brown, the bread black, the stew a creamy white. She served it in a trencher hollowed out of a stale loaf. It was thick with leeks, carrots, barley, and turnips, white and yellow, along with clams and chunks of cod and crab meat, swimming in a stock of heavy cream and butter. It was the sort of stew that warmed a man right down to his bones, just the thing for a wet, cold night. Davos spooned it up gratefully.
You have tasted sister's stew before?
I have, my lord.
The same stew was served all over the Three Sisters, in every inn and tavern.
This is better than what you've had before. Gela makes it, my daughter's daughter. Are you married on your night?
I am, my lord.
A pity. Gellar's not. Homely women make the best wives. There's three kinds of crabs in there. Red crabs, and spider crabs, and conquerors. I won't eat spider crab, except in sister's stew. Makes me feel half a cannibal. His lordship gestured at the banner hanging above the coal-black hearth. A spider crab was embroidered there, white on a grey-green field. We heard tales that Stannis burned his hand.
The hand who went before me.
Melisandre had given Alistair Florent to her guard on Dragonstone to conjure up the wind that bore them north. Lord Florent had been strong and silent as the Queen's men bound him to the post, as dignified as any half-naked man could hope to be. But as the flames licked up his legs, he had begun to scream, and his screams had blown them all the way to Eastwatch by the sea, if the Red Woman could be believed. Davos had misliked that wind. It had seemed to him to smell of burning flesh, and the sound of it was anguished as it played amongst the lines. It could as easily have been me. I did not burn, he assured Lord Godric, though Eastwatch almost froze me. The wall will do that. The woman brought them a fresh loaf of bread, still hot from the oven. When Davos saw her hand, he stared. Lord Godric did not fail to make note of it. Aye, she has a mark, like all Borrels, for 5,000 years. My daughter's daughter, not the one who makes the stew. He tore the bread apart and offered half to Davos. Eat! It's good! It was, though any stale crust would have tasted just as fine to Davos. It meant he was a guest here, for this one night at least. The lords of the Three Sisters had a black repute, and none more so than Godric Borrell, lord of Sweet Sister, shield of Sisterton, master of Breakwater Castle, and keeper of the Night Lamp. But even robber lords and wreckers were bound by the ancient laws of hospitality.
"I will see the dawn, at least," Davos told himself. "I have eaten of his bread and salt."
Though there were stranger spices than salt in the sister's stew.
"Is it saffron that I'm tasting?"
Saffron was worth more than gold. Davos had only tasted once before, when King Robert had sent half a fish to him at a feast on Dragonstone.
"Aye, from Carth. There's pepper, too."
Lord Godric took a pinch between his thumb and forefinger and sprinkled his own trencher.
"Cracked black pepper from Volantis, nothing finer. Take as much as you require, if you're feeling peppery. I've got 40 chests of it, not to mention cloves and nutmeg, and a pound of saffron. Took it off a slow-eyed maid."
He laughed. He still had all his teeth, Davos saw, though most of them were yellow, and one on the top was black and dead. She was making for Braavos, but a gale swept her into the bight, and she smashed up against some of my rocks. So you see, you're not the only gift the storms have brought me. The sea's a treacherous, cruel thing.
Not as treacherous as men, thought Davos.
Lord Godric's forebears had been pirate kings until the Starks came down on them with fire and sword. These days the sister men left open piracy to Salador San and his elk, and confined themselves to wrecking. The beacons that burned along the shores of the Three Sisters were supposed to warn of shoals and reefs and rocks and lead the way to safety. But on stormy nights and foggy ones, some sister men would use false lights to draw unwary captains to their dooms.
"The storms did you a kindness, blowing you to my door," Lord Godric said. "You'd have found a cool welcome in White Harbour."
"You come too late, sir. Lord Wyman means to bend his knee, and not to Stannis." He took a swallow of his beer. "The Manderleys are no Northmen, not deep down. 'Twas no more than 900 years ago when they came north, laden down with all their gold and gods. Oh, they'd been great lords on the Mander, until they overreached themselves, and the Green Hands slapped them down. The Wolf King took their gold, but he gave them land and let them keep their gods. He mopped at his stew with a chunk of bread. If Stannis thinks the fat man will ride the stag, he's wrong. The Lion Star put in at Sisterton 12 days ago to fill her water casks. Do you know her? Crimson sails and a gold line on her prow? And full of Freys making for White Harbour. Freys? That was the last thing that Davos would have expected. The Freys killed Lord Wyman's son, we heard. Aye, Lord Godric said, and the fat man was so wroth that he took a vow to live on bread and wine till he had his vengeance. But before the day was out, he was stuffing clams and cakes into his mouth again. There's ships that go between the Sisters and White Harbour all the time. We sell them crabs and fish and goat cheese. They sell us wood and wool and hides. From all I hear, his lordship's fatter than ever. So much for vows. Words are wind, and the wind from Manderley's mouth means no more than the wind escaping out his bottom. The lord tore off another chunk of bread to swipe out his trencher. The Freys were bringing the fat fool a bag of bones. Some call that courtesy, to bring a man his dead son's bones. Had it been my son, I would have returned the courtesy and thanked the Freys before I hanged them. But the fat man's too noble for that. He stuffed the bread into his mouth, chewed and swallowed. I had the Freys to supper. One sat just where you're sitting now. Rhaegar, he named himself. Ha! I almost laughed right in his face. He'd lost his wife, he said, but he meant to get himself a new one in White Harbour. Ravens have been flying back and forth. Lord Wyman and Lord Walder have made a pact, and mean to seal it with a marriage. Davos felt as though the Lord had punched him in the belly. If he tells it true, my king is lost. Stannis Baratheon had desperate need of White Harbour. If Winterfell was the heart of the North, White Harbour was its mouth. Its firth had remained free of ice even in the depths of winter for centuries. With winter coming on, that could mean much and more. So could the city's silver. The Lannisters had all the gold of Casterly Rock, and had wed the wealth of Highgarden. King Stannis's coffers were exhausted.
I must try, at least. There may be some way that I can stop this marriage.
I have to reach White Harbour, he said. Your lordship, I beg you, help me.
Lord Godric began to eat his trencher, tearing it apart in his big hands. The stew had softened the stale bread.
I have no love for Northmen, he announced. The maesters say the rape of the Three Sisters was 2,000 years ago, but Sisterton has not forgotten. We were a free people before that, with our kings ruling over us. Afterward, we had to bend our knees to the Eyrie to get the Northmen out. The Wolf and the Falcon fought over us for 1,000 years, till between the two of them they had gnawed all the fat and flesh off the bones of these poor islands. As for your King Stannis, when he was Robert's master of ships, he sent a fleet into my port without my leave, and made me hang a dozen fine friends, men like you. He went so far as to threaten to hang me, if it should happen that some ship went aground because the night lamp had gone black. I had to eat his arrogance. He ate some of the trencher. Now he comes north, humbled, with his tail between his legs. Why should I give him any aid? Answer me that.
Because he's your rightful king, Davos thought. Because he is a strong man and a just one, the only man who can restore the realm and defend it against the peril that gathers in the north. Because he has a magic sword that glows with the light of the sun.
The words caught in his throat. None of them would sway the Lord of Sweet Sister. None of them would get him a foot closer to White Harbour.
What answer does he want? Must I promise him gold we do not have? A high-born husband for his daughter's daughter? Lands, honours, titles?
Lord Alistair Florent had tried to play that game, and the king had burned him for it.
The Ander's lost his tongue, it seemed. He has no taste for sister stew. Or truth.
Lord Godric wiped his mouth.
The lion is dead, said Davos slowly.
There's your truth, my lord. Tywin Lannister is dead.
What if he is?
Who rules now in King's Landing?
Not Tommen. He's just a child.
Is it Sir Kevin?
Candlelight gleamed in Lord Godric's black eyes.
If it were, you'd be in chains. It's the Queen who rules.
Davos understood. He nurses doubts. He does not want to find himself upon the losing side.
Stannis held Storm's End against the Tyrells and the Redwynes. He took Dragonstone from the last Targaryens. He smashed the Iron Fleet off Fair Isle. This child king will not prevail against him.
This child king commands a wealth of Casterly Rock and the power of Highgarden. He has the Boltons and the Freys.
Lord Godric rubbed his chin.
Still, in this world only winter is certain. Ned Stark told my father that, here, in this very hall.
Ned Stark was here?
At the dawn of Robert's Rebellion. The Mad King had sent to the Eyrie for Stark's head, but John Arryn sent him back defiance. Galtown stayed loyal to the throne, though. To get home and call his banners, Stark had to cross the mountains to the Fingers and find a fisherman to carry him across the Bight. A storm caught them on the way. The fisherman drowned, but his daughter got Stark to the sisters before the boat went down. They say he left her with a bag of silver and a bastard in her belly. John Snow, she named him, after Arryn. Be that as it may, my father sat where I sit now when Lord Eddard came to Sisterton. Our maester urged us to send Stark's head to Aerys to prove our loyalty. It would have meant a rich reward. The Mad King was open-handed with them as pleased him. By then we knew that John Arryn had taken Goldtown, though. Robert was the first man to gain the wall, and slew Mark Grafton with his own hand. This Baratheon is fearless, I said. He fights the way a king should fight. Our maester chuckled at me, and told us that Prince Rhaegar was certain to defeat this rebel. That was when Stark said, in this world only winter is certain. We may lose our heads, it's true, but what if we prevail? My father sent him on his way, with his head still on his shoulders. If you lose, he told Lord Eddard, you were never here.
No more than I was, said Davos Seaworth.
John. They brought forth the king beyond the wall, with his hands bound by hempen rope and a noose around his neck. The other end of the rope was looped about the saddle horn of Sir Godfrey Fairing's courser. The giant slayer and his mount were armoured in silver steel inlaid with Niello. Mance Rayder wore only a thin tunic that left his limbs naked to the cold. They could have let him keep his cloak, Jon Snow thought, the one the wilding woman patched, with strips of crimson silk. Small wonder that the wall was weeping. Mance knows the haunted forest better than any ranger, John had told King Stannis, in his final effort to convince his grace that the king beyond the wall would be of more use to them alive than dead. He knows Tormund Giantsbane. He has fought the others, and he had the horn of Joramun and did not blow it. He did not bring down the wall when he could have. His words fell on deaf ears. Stannis had remained unmoved. The law was plain. A deserter's life was forfeit. Beneath the weeping wall, Nailin Melisandre raised her pale white hands.
"We all must choose," she proclaimed, "man or woman, young or old, lord or peasant. Our choices are the same."
Her voice made Jon Snow think of anise and nutmeg and cloves. She stood at the king's side, on a wooden scaffold raised above the pit.
"We choose light or we choose darkness. We choose good or we choose evil. We choose the true God or the false."
Mansrader's thick grey-brown hair blew about his face as he walked. He pushed it from his eyes with bound hands, smiling. But when he saw the cage, his courage failed him. The Queen's men had made it from the trees of the haunted forest, from saplings and supple branches, pine boughs sticky with sap, and the bone-white fingers of the weirwoods. They bent them, and twisted them around and through each other to weave a wooden lattice, then hung it high above a deep pit filled with logs, leaves, and kindling. The wildling king recoiled from the sight.
"No!" he cried. "Mercy! This is not right! I am not the king there!"
Sir Godfrey gave a pull on the rope. The king beyond the wall had no choice but to stumble after him, the rope choking off his words. When he lost his feet, Godfrey dragged him the rest of the way. Mance was bloody when the queen's men half-shoved, half-carried him to the cage. A dozen men-at-arms heaved together to hoist him into the air. Lady Melisandre watched him rise.
"Free folk, here stands your king of lies, and here is the horn he promised would bring down the wall."
Two queen's men brought forth the horn of Joroman, black and banded with old gold, 8 feet long from end to end. Runes were carved into the golden bands, the writing of the first men. Joroman had died thousands of years ago, but Mance had found his grave beneath a glacier, high up in the Frostfangs. And Joroman blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. Egret had told John that Mance never found the horn. She lied, or else Mance kept it secret even from his own. 1,000 captives watched through the wooden bars of their stockade as the horn was lifted high. All were ragged and half-starved. Wildlings, the Seven Kingdoms called them. They named themselves the Free Folk. They looked neither wild nor free, only hungry, frightened, numb.
"The Horn of Joroman," Melisandre said. "No, call it the Horn of Darkness. If the wall falls, night falls as well. The long night that never ends, it must not happen. Will not happen. The Lord of Light has seen his children in their peril and sent a champion to them, Azor Ahai, reborn." She swept a hand towards Stannis, and the great ruby at her throat pulsed with light. "He is stone, and she is flame." The king's eyes were blue bruises sunk deep in a hollow face. He wore grey plate, a fur-trimmed cloak of cloth of gold flowing from his broad shoulders. His breastplate had a flaming heart inlaid above his own. Girding his brows was a red-gold crown with points like twisting flames. Val stood beside him, tall and fair. They had crowned her with a simple circlet of dark bronze, yet she looked more regal in bronze than Stannis did in gold. Her eyes were grey and fearless, unflinching. Beneath an ermine cloak, she wore white and gold. Her honey-blonde hair had been done up in a thick braid that hung over her right shoulder to her waist. The chill in the air had put colour in her cheeks. Lady Melisandre wore no crown, but every man there knew that she was Stannis Baratheon's real queen, not the homely woman he had left to shiver at Eastwatch by the sea. Talk was the king did not mean to send for Queen Selyse and their daughter until the night fort was ready for habitation. John felt sorry for them. The wall offered few of the comforts that Southron ladies and little highborn girls were used to, and the night fort offered none. That was a grim place, even at the best of times. "Free folk," cried Melisandre, "behold the fate of those who choose the darkness."
The horn of Joroman burst into flame. It went up with a whoosh as swirling tongues of green and yellow fire leapt up, crackling all along its length. John's Garen shied nervously, and up and down the ranks others fought to still their mounts as well. A moan came from the stockade as the free folk saw their hope afire. A few began to shout and curse, but most lapsed into silence. For half a heartbeat, the runes, graven on the gold band, seemed to shimmer in the air. The Queen's men gave a heave, and sent the horn tumbling down into the fire pit. Inside his cage, Mance Raider clawed at the noose about his neck with bound hands and screamed incoherently of treachery and witchery, denying his kingship, denying his people, denying his name, denying all that he had ever been. He shrieked for mercy and cursed the Red Woman and began to laugh hysterically. John watched unblinking. He dare not appear squeamish before his brothers. He had ordered out 200 men, more than half the garrison of Castle Black, mounted in solemn sable ranks, with tall spears in hand. They had drawn up their hoods to shadow their faces and hide the fact that so many were greybeards and green boys. The free folk feared the watch. John wanted them to take that fear with them to their new home south of the wall. The horn crashed amongst the logs and leaves and kindling. Within 3 heartbeats, the whole pit was aflame. Clutching the bars of his cage with bound hands, Mance sobbed and begged. When the fire reached him, he did a little dance. His screams became one long, wordless shriek of fear and pain. Within his cage, he fluttered like a burning leaf, a moth caught in a candle flame. John found himself remembering a song. "Brothers, O brothers, my days here are done. The Dornishman's taken my life. But what does it matter? For all men must die, and I've tasted the Dornishman's wife." Val stood on the platform as still as if she'd been carved of salt. She will not weep, nor look away. John wondered what Ygritte would have done in her place. The women are the strong ones. He found himself thinking about Sam and Maester Aemon, about Gilly and the babe. "She will curse me with her dying breath, but I saw no other way." Eastwatch reported savage storms upon the narrow sea. I meant to keep them safe. Did I feed them to the crabs instead? Last night he had dreamed of Sam drowning, of Ygritte dying with his own arrow in her. It had not been his arrow, but in his dreams it always was. Of Gilly weeping tears of blood. Jon Snow had seen enough. "Now," he said. Alma of the Kingswood jammed his spear into the ground, unslung his bow, and slipped a black arrow from his quiver. Sweet Donald Hill threw back his hood to do the same. Garth Greyfeather and Bearded Ben knocked shafts, bent their bows, loosed. One arrow took Mance Raider in the chest, one in the gut, one in the throat. The four struck one of the cage's wooden bars and quivered for an instant before catching fire. A woman's sobs echoed off the wall as the wildling king slid bonelessly to the floor of his cage, wreathed in fire. "And now his watch is done," John murmured softly. Mance Raider had been a man of the night's watch once, before he changed his black cloak for one slashed with bright red silk. Up on the platform, Stannis was scowling. John refused to meet his eyes. The bottom had fallen out of the wooden cage, and its bars were crumbling. Every time the fire licked upward, more branches tumbled free, cherry red and black.
"The Lord of Light made the sun and moon and stars to light our way, and gave us fire to keep the night at bay," Melisandre told the wildlings. "None can withstand his flames."
"None can withstand his flames," the Queen's men echoed.
The Red Woman's robes of deep-dyed scarlet swirled about her, and her coppery hair made a halo round her face. Tall yellow flames danced from her fingertips like claws.
"Free folk, your false gods cannot help you. Your false horn did not save you. Your false king brought you only death, despair, defeat. But here stands the true king. Behold his glory.
Stannis Baratheon drew Lightbringer. The sword glowed, red and yellow and orange, alive with light. Jon had seen the show before, but not like this. Never before like this. Lightbringer was the sun made steel. When Stannis raised the blade above his head, men had to turn their heads or cover their eyes. Horses shied, and one threw his rider. The blaze in the fire pit seemed to shrink before this storm of light, like a small dog cowering before a larger one. The wall itself turned red and pink and orange as waves of color danced across the ice. Is this the power of king's blood? Westeros has but one king, said Stannis. His voice rang harsh with none of Melisandre's music. With this sword I defend my subjects and destroy those who menace them. Bend the knee, and I promise you food, land, and justice. Kneel and live, or go and die. The choice is yours. He slipped Lightbringer into its scabbard, and the world darkened once again, as if the sun had gone behind a cloud. Open the gates! Open the gates! Bellowed Sir Clayton Suggs, in a voice as deep as a war horn. Open the gates! Echoed Sir Corlys Penny, commanding the guards. Open the gates! Cried the sergeants. Men scrambled to obey. Sharpened stakes were wrenched from the ground, planks were dropped across deep ditches, and the stockade gates were thrown wide. Jon Snow raised his hand and lowered it, and his black ranks parted right and left, clearing a path to the wall, where Dolorous Ed Tollett pushed open the iron gate. Come, urged Melisandre, come to the light, or run back to the darkness. In the pit below her, the fire was crackling. If you choose life, come to me. And they came, slowly at first, some limping or leaning on their fellows. The captives began to emerge from their rough-hewn pen. If you would eat, come to me, John thought. If you would not freeze or starve, submit. Hesitant, wary of some trap, the first few prisoners edged across the planks and through the ring of stakes, toward Melisandre and the wall. More followed when they saw that no harm had come to those who went before, then more, until it was a steady stream. Queen's men in studded jacks and half-helms handed each passing man, woman, or child a piece of white weirwood, a stick, a splintered branch as pale as broken bone, a spray of blood-red leaves. A piece of the old guards to feed the new. John flexed the fingers of his sword hand. The heat from the fire pit was palpable even at a distance. For the wildlings, it had to be blistering. He saw men cringing as they neared the flames, heard children cry. A few turned for the forest. He watched a young woman stumble away with a child on either hand. Every few steps, she looked back to make certain no one was coming after them, and when she neared the trees, she broke into a run. One greybeard took their weirwood branch they handed him and used it as a weapon, laying about with it until the queen's men converged on him with spears. The others had to step around his body until Sir Corlys had it thrown in the fire. More of the free folk chose the woods after that, 1 in 10, perhaps. But most came on. Behind them was only cold and death. Ahead was hope. They came on, clutching their scraps of wood, until the time came to feed them to the flames. R'hllor was a jealous deity, ever hungry. So the new god devoured the corpse of the old, and cast gigantic shadows of Stannis and Melisandre upon the wall, black against the ruddy red reflections on the ice. Sigorn was the first to kneel before the king. The new Magnothen was a younger, shorter version of his father, lean, balding, clad in bronze greaves and a leather shirt sewn with bronze scales. Next came Rattleshirt, in clattering armor made of bones and boiled leather, his helm a giant's skull. Under the bones lurked a ruined and wretched creature with cracked brown teeth and a yellow tinge to the whites of his eyes. A small, malicious, treacherous man, as stupid as he is cruel. John did not believe for a moment that he would keep faith. He wondered what Val was feeling as she watched him kneel, forgiven. Lesser leaders followed. Two clan chiefs of the Hornfoot men, whose feet were black and hard, an old wise woman revered by the peoples of the Milkwater, a scrawny dark-eyed boy of 2 and 10, the son of Alfin Crowkiller, Halleck, brother to Harmer Dogshead, with her pigs. Each took a knee before the king. "It is too cold for this mama show," thought John. "The free folk despise kneelers," he had warned Stannis. "Let them keep their pride, and they will love you better." His grace would not listen. He said, "It is swords I need from them, not kisses." Having knelt, the wildling shuffled past the ranks of the Black Brothers to the gate. John had detailed horse and satin and half a dozen others to lead them through the wall with torches. On the far side, bowls of hot onion soup awaited them, and chunks of black bread and sausage. Clothes as well, cloaks, breeches, boots, tunics, good leather gloves. They would sleep on piles of clean straw, with fires blazing to keep the chill of night at bay. This king was nothing if not methodical. Soon or late, however, Tormund Giantsbane would assault the wall again, and when that hour came, John wondered whose side Stannis' new-made subjects would choose. You can give them land and mercy, but the free folk choose their own kings, and it was Mance they chose, not you. Bowen Marsh edged his mount up next to John's. "This is a day I never thought to see." The Lord Steward had thinned notably since suffering a head wound at the Bridge of Skulls. Part of one ear was gone. "He no longer looks much like a pomegranate," John thought. Marsh said, "We bled to stop the wildlings at the gorge. Good men were slain there, friends and brothers. For what?" "The realm will curse us all for this," declared Sir Alistair Thorne in a venomous tone. "Every honest man in Westeros will turn his head and spit at the mention of the Night's Watch." "What would you know of honest men?" "Quiet in the ranks!" Sir Alistair had grown more circumspect since Lord Janus had lost his head. But the malice was still there. John had toyed with the idea of giving him the commands Slint had refused, but he wanted the man close. He was always the more dangerous of the two. Instead, he had dispatched a grizzled steward from the Shadow Tower to take command at Greyguard. He hoped the two new garrisons would make a difference. "The watch can make the free folk bleed, but in the end we cannot hope to stop them." Giving Mance Rayder to the fire did not change the truth of that. "We are still too few, and they are still too many, and without rangers we're good as blind. I have to send men out, but if I do, will they come back again?" The tunnel through the wall was narrow and twisting, and many of the wildlings were old or ill or wounded, so the going was painfully slow. By the time the last of them had bent the knee, night had fallen. The pit fire was burning low, and the king's shadow on the wall had shrunk to a quarter of its former height. Jon Snow could see his breath in the air. "Cold," he thought, "and getting colder. This mama show has gone on long enough." 20 captives lingered by the stockade. 4 giants were among them, massive, hairy creatures with sloped shoulders, legs as large as tree trunks, and huge, splayed feet. Big as they were, they might still have passed through the wall, but one would not leave his mammoth, and the others would not leave him. The rest of those who remained were all of human stature. Some were dead, and some were dying. More were their kin, or close companions, unwilling to abandon them even for a bowl of onion soup. Some shivering, some too numb to shiver, they listened as the king's voice rumbled off the wall. "You are free to go," Stannis told them.
Tell your people what you witnessed. Tell them that you saw the true king and that they are welcome in his realm, so long as they keep his peace. Elsewise, they had best flee or hide. I will